This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Stephen Daisley. It appears we're edging towards a result in the Scottish Parliament elections. We know Nicola Sturgeon has been going for a majority here, but Stephen, as things stand, that is looking quite unlikely.
Well, yes, the great and powerful odds of electoral predictions, Professor Sir John Curtis has suggested that the path to an outright SNP majority may now be closed. That is a function of the SNP failing to pick up a number of constituencies that they were generally expected to win going into this election. So the one that we've heard the result from most recently was Aberdeenshire West, which the Tories held, but also yesterday Eastwood, which was held by the Tories, and Dumbarton, which was the most marginal seat in Scotland, held by Labour's Jackie Bailey. Most commentators, you know, most even sort of Labour activists thought that it was gone. In fact, Jackie Bailey managed to put up her majority and defeat the SNP in that seat for the sixth time in a row. And because of the proportional list system in Scotland, where the list seats sort of balance out the first past the post constituencies, it makes it essentially all but impossible for the SNP to get an outright majority to hit that magic 65 number.
James, are we seeing tactical voting from the unionists here paying off?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that Jackie Bailey was helped by tactical voting in Dumbarton. It's clear there was tactical voting in Aberdeenshire West to help the Tories hold that seat. I think, in a way, this is why this is a bad proxy for the question of independent opinion in Scotland, because there are obviously three sizable pro-union parties in Scotland, Tories, Labour and Liberal Democrats. And on the pro-independent side, there's the SNP, there are the Greens, who, interestingly, a poll during the campaign suggested that most Green voters weren't actually in favour of independence, and ALBA, Alex Salmond's party, which looks like it's failed to gain a single seat. So the Scottish Parliament will not have an SNP majority, but it will have a pro-independence majority. But if you think that everyone is voting on the constitution, which I'm not sure is entirely correct, but if you think that is what everyone is doing, it is worth noting that the pro-independence parties are not getting over 50% of the vote.
Stephen, where does the SNP go from here? Nicola Sturgeon and her supporters have been suggesting IndyRef 2 requests are coming, but are they, if as we now expect, the SNP is perhaps two, perhaps on a good night, if they get one short of a majority?
Oh, I think there was a very telling moment during the final TV debate in this election on the BBC, and the BBC's Glen Campbell put it to Nicola Sturgeon: what if there are people who want to vote for you because they like your government, or they like the SNP, or they like their local school or something like that, but they don't support independence? And she said, well, they should vote SNP. But her message throughout the campaign has been that voting SNP will create a mandate for a second referendum. And in fact, that was exactly what Nicola Sturgeon said in 2016. She said that you could vote for the SNP to express your support for a second referendum, but also if you didn't support one, you could also vote SNP. So the talk of mandate is very difficult, quite apart from the fact that the powers are reserved to Westminster. You know, Nicola Sturgeon does have a problem in that she has an activist base in her party who are, you know, impatient. Not all of them, but many of them are impatient for a second referendum. They have just gone through a year of, until recently, polls solidly showing a majority for yes, to polls that showed and still show Nicola Sturgeon being, you know, far and away the most popular politician in Scotland. A lot of that is, I think, to do with the pandemic and the sort of perception of her leadership of that. You know, at some point she's going to have to move. Now, she's suggested, during the campaign, she suggested both that it could be in the first half of the parliament and then that, no, it would be after the recovery, but it's not quite clear how she, you know, defines the recovery. And yet she also said that, you know, we had to sort of have, independence so we could get the right kind of recovery. I think a lot of this will come down to how Nicola Sturgeon reads the ruins in terms of public opinion, her likelihood to be able to win a referendum, and also what her party will, you know, allow her to do. The fact that Alex Salmond's challenge has failed, and he was going for those kind of people, impatient people within the SNP, I think that gives her breathing space. I really think it does. I think that suggests that either those people aren't as many as were thought, or that they are not quite as militant, if you like. So that does give her breathing space, but at the end of the day, she has said that, you know, that this election was about creating a mandate for independence. Yes, the SNP may have fallen short of an overall majority, but there will be a pro-independence majority with the Scottish Greens, and they are, you know, very loyal to the SNP. So it will be difficult for her, if she wants to call Annie, it will be difficult for her to explain that to some in her party, because she has the majority that between her and the Greens that she says was important. And yes, some polls recently have showed a drop in support for independence, but among her sort of most fervent believers, they believe that this might be their last chance, at least for a generation.
James, do you think there'll be celebrations in Downing Street if, as we expect, the SNP do fail to secure that majority, which now seems very unlikely?
I think it makes it easier to reject demands for a second independence referendum. If you look at these election results, it's very tempting to see Scotland as divided into two camps, a kind of unionist camp and a nationalist camp. I mean, actually, the Scottish electorate splits kind of three ways. There are kind of hardcore unionists who would never vote for independence. There are nationalists who would vote for independence come what may, regardless of the currency or the border or any of the other kind of economic issues. And then there is a kind of middle slice of the electorate who haven't yet definitively made up their mind. And that, I think, is who the UK government need to concentrate on as they reply. So I mean, they need to do a couple of things. The first thing is, let Nicola Sturgeon make the running on this. We know all the polling suggests that a referendum within the next 2 years is not a priority for Scottish voters. Most people don't think that's a good idea. The SNP manifesto committed them to one within the next 2.5 years. So I think Boris Johnson made a misstep today when he said, oh, there'll be no, in that Daily Telegraph interview, there'll be no Scottish referendum. I think rather you should say, look, I haven't received a request for one, and I would imagine that Nicola Sturgeon would want to get on with handling the pandemic. When that request does come in, I think he should simply say, now is not the time, and refuse a Section 30 order on that basis. That is what all the polling, again, suggests, that those crucial middle ground voters regard as the most reasonable approach. Now, I suspect that in those circumstances, the Parliament would legislate for it anyway. And Nicola Sturgeon has already come out yesterday saying, come on, well, Boris Johnson, you know, we'll see him in the Supreme Court if he wants to stop it. And it's quite clear the headlines that Nicola Sturgeon is trying to create with that kind of rhetoric. She wants the Westminster government to kind of go to court to stop Scottish people having their say on this. I don't think there's any need for the UK government to play this game. Let one of the many private citizens in Scotland, you know, maybe Stephen, could take this case to the Court of Session in Edinburgh. I think legally I expect they would win. I mean, there is a potential wrinkle, as I say in the magazine this week, that you could argue that because this referendum would have no legal effect, you're not impinging on Westminster's reserve right in the Constitution. But in those circumstances, rather than trying to kind of shut the poll down, unions should simply boycott it and should mock the absurdity of spending time and money on a referendum that is only taking place because it is supposedly going to have no effect.
Stephen, do you agree?
No, I'm afraid I won't be taking that case to the Court of Session or indeed the Supreme Court. In fact, and I would cite James's piece. It was a very good piece about the fact that there is this problem with, I think it's two Supreme Court decisions in relation to Brexit that does open up the possibility that the SNP can go forward with the referendum and it not be unlawful. And you know, this gets to a fundamental question, is where does sovereignty lie? You know, and this is not an abstract question, and I'm not someone who kind of fetishizes sovereignty. You know, I was a Remainer. I wasn't, you know, one of these kind of Brexiteers who talking about sovereignty. But fundamentally, in your country, you have to know where sovereignty lies and where decisions can be made. And, you know, I like the British Constitution as much as the next person who likes an absolute complete muddle that no one can make sense of. But when it comes to something as fundamental as the continuance of the state, you do need to have clarity on that. And you do need to know. And so that's why, you know, I've advocated for a while. You have people like Professor Adam Tompkins, who's a professor of law at Glasgow University, a former Conservative MSP, also argues for a new act of the Union that defines where sovereignty lies and also sets out the circumstances in which a secession referendum can be lawfully held. So that would be the approach I would take, whether that's the approach that Downing Street wants to take, because obviously there's all kinds of political baggage with that, and it would require, you know, almost Brexit levels of investment of government time and attention to achieve that. And the question is whether Downing Street thinks that that's a wise use of its time.
James, elsewhere in terms of results that we've got coming in from the elections, we have Sadiq Khan, still expecting him to likely win, but in much more trouble than we expected. On first preferences, it looked at one point very close with Sean Bailey. Do you think that there's been a misjudgment of the state of the London mayoral case? Because lots of polling and also, I think, commentary on that race put Sadiq Khan far ahead and Sean Bailey's campaign as a bit of a disaster.
I think given the areas in London still to declare, I think Sadiq Khan is still going to win quite handily. I think what the margin shows, though, is that Londoners don't think that Sadiq Khan is doing the kind of job that voters in Greater Manchester think that Andy Burnham is doing, or that voters in Teesside think Ben Houchen is doing. And I think if you think about Sadiq Khan and Andy Burnham as kind of, with the Labour Party in another bout of soul-searching, as kind of two princes across the water, I think it's Andy Burnham's position is much stronger this evening than Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan has turned in a not particularly impressive result against a not particularly impressive Tory campaign in London. Andy Burnham has won very handsomely in Manchester. So I think Andy Burnham's stock in the Labour Party is rising. I think there will be, I think you're already beginning to see some people say, well, you know, maybe he's the answer. You know, maybe Andy Burnham, who was an MP for a seat that is now held by the Conservatives, you know, in Lee, in the so-called Red Wall, maybe given Labour's trouble in the North, to have Andy Burnham, who had positioned himself in the pandemic as this kind of mayor standing up, not just for Greater Manchester, but the North more generally, which was under tighter COVID restrictions because of the infection levels, that idea will gain traction. Now, I don't think Andy Burnham is about to find a by-election and a route back to Westminster, but I think his and Mark Drakeford are the two Labour figures whose stock has risen in the last few days. And you can't say that about many people in the Labour Party after this set of elections.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Stephen. And thank you for listening.